Medieval Chivalry. Chaucer's England was predominantly medieval in spirit, and the most outstanding feature of the medieval age was chivalry. Chaucer's knight is a true representative of the spirit of medieval chivalry, which was a blend of love, religion, and bravery. He has been a champion of not fewer than 15 battles in the defense of Christianity. Even the tale that he tells is like him, imbued by with the him spirit of medieval chivalry, though normally it has the ancient Greek for its setting and has for its two important characters the two Greek heroes who are said to have flourished in an unspecified period of history. Chaucer almost completely medievalizes this story to enable us to have a taste of chivalry of his age. We must, however, point out here that the spirit of true chivalry was breathing its last in the age of Chaucer. The knight, in fact, is a representative of an order which was losing its ground. The true representative of the new order in his young son, the Squire, Squire, who has as much taste for revelry, revelry, as for chivalry. He is, a lover and a lusty bachelor, He is singing and flirting all the days, and love struck as he is, he sleeps, no more than a nightingale. However, we justly wondered if he could have proved himself another Arcite or another Palamon. At any rate, he truly represents the marked change in the world of chivalry which was fast coming over the age of Chaucer. Next topic, a cross section of society. The Centenary Tales gives us a fairly authentic and equally extensive picture of the socio-political conditions prevailing in England in the age of Chaucer. Each of the 30 pilgrims hails from a different walk of life, and among themselves they build up an epitome, E-P-I-T-O-M-E, of their age. Each of them is representative of a section of society as well as an individual. Even though the chief event of the age are not dealt with exhaustively by Chaucer, the 30 pilgrims provide us with the taste of life in the England of Chaucer. Chaucer was not a reformer but a delineator of reality. Lewis remarks, "What he has given is a direct transcription of daily life, taken in the very act, as it were, and in its most familiar aspect." Chaucer's work is the most precious document for, however, wishes to evoke a picture of life as it then was. Next topic, commerce and craft. For the first time in history, the trading and the artisan section of society were coming to their own in the age of Chaucer. With the fast expansion in trade and commerce, merchants had become prosperous, and so had to craftsmen whose good they trade in. We are told by Chaucer that a haberdasher by carpenter, the weaver and the dyer, D-Y-E-R, and the tapisser, T-A-P-I-C-E-R, were well clothed and equipped. Their weapons were not chiefly trimmed with brass, but all with silver. They were so respectable looking that, well seemed each of them a fair burgess to sit in eld hall on a days. They were no longer despised by the nobility. The merchant is a typical representative of his class, and the forefather of Sir Andrew Freeport, the merchant, who is a member of a spectator club as delineated by Addison and Steele in the 18th century. His character sketch, as done by Chaucer, exuded prosperity. He is always talking about the increase in his income and known well how to make money in the marketplace. The countryman and the merchant have always made the two most common objects of humor and satire. But Chaucer lets the merchant go without much of satire, perhaps in recognition of the importance that his class had gained in his age. Medicine. Chaucer portrayed the doctors of physics is fairly representative of the theory and practice of medicine in his age. The knowledge of astronomy, rather astrology, was a must for a physician, as all the physical ailment were supposed to be the consequence of the peculiar configuration of stars and planets. That is why the doctor too was grounded in astronomy. However, his study was but little and the Bible. Perhaps because he had not much time to spare from his professional studies, he had amassed a fortune in the year of the Great Plague and was keen to keep it with him. He kept that he went to pestilence, for gold in physic is a cordial, therefore he loved gold in special. Gold in the form of a colloidal solution was administered as a tonic by physicians. However, Chaucer has a sly dig at the doctor in his reference to his gold-loving nature. The Church. Through the ecclesiastical character in the Sainsbury Tales, Chaucer constructs a representative picture of the condition of the Church and her ministers in his age. The Church had then become a hotbed of profligacy, corruption, and rank materialism. The monk, the friar, the seminar, and the pardoner, and the prioress are all corrupt, pleasure-loving, and materialistic in outlook. They forget their primary duty of guiding and edifying the masses and the shepherding them to the promised land. The monk is a fat, a sporting fellow, averse to study and penance. The friar is a jolly beggar who employs his tongue to carve out his living. The prioress brother, more about modest etiquette than austerity, austerity. The pardoner, his despicable parasite, trading in letter of pardon with the sinners who could injure a seat in heaven by paying hard cash. The seminar is likewise a depraved fellow. These characters fully signifies the descendants had crept into the Church. The only exception is the poor person, apparently a follower of Wycliffe, who revolt against the corruption of the Church. Next topic, the new learning. Though Chaucer age was essentially medieval, at some sort of a minor renaissance was evident. The French and Italian contemporary writer influenced considerably the course of English literature and thought. Petrarch, the Boccaccio, and the two Italian writers in particular exert this influence. The seeds and the humanistic culture of the ancient Greeks to can to identify in this age. The Clerk of Oxenford represents the new intellectual culture which had percolated into the 14th century England long before the Renaissance. He is an austere scholar who prefers 20 books of Aristotle philosophy on his bed's head to gay cloths and musical instruments. The next question, Chaucer as a realist. The Lewis, in his History of English Literature, written by him in collaboration with Kazamian, pay a high but just tribute to Chaucer's realism and his self-effacement in his observation and recording of the life of his age. That he has effectively captured for us the body and soul of his age has been universally recognized. One reason why his work is so authentic and impressive is that he has a tendency of affect himself. Were he more obsessive and more self-centered, or more detective and reform-minded, his work would have been proportionally less realistic, less interesting and less convincing. The next topic, Chaucer's Chosen Fields. The vivid and authentic portrayal of the life and the manner of his age was Chaucer's chosen field, for which nature and experience had occupied him so exclusively. But Chaucer came to this field after a long journey in the dim valley of allegory and dream poetry based on his contemporary French and Italian models. It was only when he was about 50 that he realized that his real field lay elsewhere. With the Saintsbury Tales, Chaucer's aim and practice as a poet underwent a sea change. The descendant from a ethereal regions of romance and allegory and the dream world of conventional literature and planted his feet firmly on the ground. Here, to quote an opinion, the fantastic world of romance and allegory melt away. Troy and Thebes, places made of glass and temples of brass, allegorical garden and marvelous fountain evaporate, and their place we see the whole stream of English society in the 14th century. In Saintsbury Tales, nature herself became Chaucer's model. He saw what was the painted that he saw. Next topic, no complete self-effacement. Chaucer could have claimed, like Fielding, that he gave the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. He was decidedly the first realist in the English literature. Much of his realism is indebted to his tendency toward self-effacement, which is necessary for a dramatist and very desirable for a novelist. The dramatist himself does not appear on the stage. He reveals his characters through what they say and do, and does not offer to interpret for the reader or a spectator their words and deeds. The novelist does likewise, though he is much freer than the dramatist. Chaucer has well been called the first novelist even before the appearance of the novel, as also the first dramatist before the appearance of the drama in England. Nevertheless, it must be emphasized that so far as the Saintsbury Tales is concerned, Chaucer does not affect himself completely, though he does see what is and does paint it as he see it. It's particularly true of the prologue, where he himself seems to very much present like the guide in the picture gallery, nudging the spectator with his elbow and directing his attention to this or that feature, one portrait to other. In the tales proper, however, the writer disappears completely and presents himself only as a reporter of the words and the deeds of pilgrims on the road, who go justly and storytelling and raising a cloud of dust behind them. Thus, whereas in the prologue, Chaucer adopts the static mode of characterization, in the tales, he adopts the dramatic mode. In the prologue, it is he who is supposed to be enlightening us about the dress, appearance, habit, and salient traits and pilgrims. In the tales, he lets them to do it for themselves. The prologue. Next topic. Irrespective of the question whether Chaucer affaces himself or not in the prologue, it is commonly considered of the characters he draw are thoroughly realistic. All of them seems to have been drawn from life. His portraits show how penetratingly observant an eye he possessed. He records the minutes details and appearance, dress and behavior of the pilgrims, makes their portrait disarmingly conceiving. Consider, for instance, a description of the miller. His bird as any saw or fox was red, and threat of broad day as though it were a sped. What makes these portraits all the more realistic is the seeming spontaneity with which Chaucer draws them. When Chaucer is telling us something about a pilgrim, it seems that he or she is standing right before him and he is looking at what is an painting. What he is looking at, Chaucer used that greatest of arts which lies in concealing, concealing, all semblance, semblance of art. No small part of the realism and these portraits, says W. H. Clausen. Is there informality there, lack of regular order? The details about the pilgrim seems to be coming from him about any method of design, and that is exactly what induced in the reader a strong feeling of the actuality of the characters who are being so described. Another relevant point to be kept in view is Chaucer's broad-mindedness, his lack of prejudice, and his real sympathy with all classes and conditions of people, irrespective of the fact whether he is dealing with a rascal or a saint, an angel or a devil. He shows to trace of either anger and bitterness or excessive reverence. He rejects nothing but likes all. He leaves the task of improving the world to his contemporaries, such as Longlands, Wycliffe, and the moral Gower. As for himself, he accepts the words as he finds. He paints many rascals. Indeed, most of the pilgrims are in fact rascals. Without pillorying, pillorying, or strongly indicting any one of them, he is too indulgent and tolerant for that. His all-embracing human sympathy prevents him from standing between the portrait and the spectator. Let the spectator himself judge and arrange if he likes the characters whose portrait he has drawn. The painter works his work. We may also notice the happy absence of idealization from Chaucer's character's portrayal. The characters of the knight, the ploughman, and the poor parson are the only exceptions. The character are so lifelike that some critics have suggested that Chaucer might have painted from real life. J.M. Manley, for instance, opines that Chaucer had in mind some definitive person. While portraying the pilgrims in the prologue, it will be an ideal pastime to contest issued with this critics. We should not approach literature with the attitude of a detective to search into the raw material with a creative artist employs. It is enough for us to recognize the fact that Chaucer's character are very lifelike. His character, in the words of Palgrave, are seen in his mind so widely that we know them more clearly than the men we see. What we should insist on is not the actuality of a writer's work, but the verisimilitude, verisimilitude, what a writer gives may not, and should not be a literal transcription of reality, but only a semblance of it. Aristotle considered poetry from philosophical and more real than history, and he is quite right to say that Chaucer copied real character from life will be underrating his literary genius. His is not a mechanic's art, well does A. C. Ward remark. It would of course be foolish to suppose that everything in the prologue is from the life. Chaucer was due to do good an artist and had too lively an imagination to be a mere copyist, even of life itself. Life was only his raw material to which he could on occasion give a more convincing and satisfying shape than nature's own. So we can only guess at how far Chaucer drew upon imparted information and how far upon his own sense of probability.
The Tales. Unlike in the prologue, in the Tales proper, Chaucer effaces himself completely like a perfect dramatist. He is there, of course, and he is one of the pilgrims too, but he is there as a spectator and the authentic reporter. In the Tales, the portrait walk out of their frame, as it were, and reveals themselves through the tales they narrate, the comment which they make on each other tales, and their mutual exchange and even skirmishes. Skirmishes. It is in the Tales that the author disappear completely. Right in the beginning of the prologue, Chaucer takes pain
emphasize his role as a mere reporter. He feign, feigns, even to have reproduced the very words spoken by the pilgrims in the narration of their tales. For this a no man also well as I, who so shall tell after a man, he would rehearse a nigh as ever he can, average a word if it be in his charge, all speak he never so redolent and large, or else moots tells his tales untrue, or fine things or friend in words new. So the author bows out of the scenes and assumes the role of a spectator and reporter. Each story is intended to reveal its narrator. Lewis maintains in a noted comma, it then behoves the author to conceal himself, to sacrifice his own literary talent and sense of proportion, and give place to another who may be ignorant, churlish, clumsy, clumsy, foolish, and coarse, coarse, or moved by enthusiasm and prejudice, inspired by his creator. And what a sacrifice, says the same critic. In the Sainsbury Tales, the element of the poet personality has been subdued, superseded by pleasure in living and understanding hitherto, hitherto, by degree of peaceful impartial spectatorship had never been reached by poets. In order to come close, it is interesting to note how the Tales of each pilgrim is in conformity with his or her character, in glimpse of which is provided by the poet in the prologue. Is many a case of story gives finishing touch to the portrait of the narrator as an initial set forth in the prologue. Chaucer here seems to have followed the classical principle of decorum without being aware of it. And it is not only the content of each story but also its diction which reveals its narrator, the prioress being an ecclesiastic tells. Appropriately enough, the story of a Christian saint murdered by the cursed Jew. The knight comes out with a tales of chivalry. The merry sporting monk, on being exhorted by the host of tell a merry tale, revengefully narrator a long melancholy tale of fall of Lucifer, Adam, Samson, Hercules, and many more. But he is shut off midway by the fervent words of the host. Sir monk, no more of this, so God you blesses. Your tells Neothe, A-N-O-Y-E-T-H, all this company. He asks the monk of narrator instead of a story of hunting, but the latter does not oblige and retries sinly. The tipsy miller offered to tell a body, B-A-W-D-Y, story of the seduction and carpenter's wife by a clerk. The Rivi, R-E-V-E, in bracket, who does the work of a carpenter also, you know, bracket closed, protest at the miller's lewd, drunken harlotry, H-A-R-L-O-T-R-Y-E. It is a sin and a great flaw to appear in any man or him defame, and it brazen weaves in switch of fame. Thou mast enough of other things and shan. But the miller ignore his protest and tells his ribald story. The Rivi in retaliation narrator the story of the seduction of the miller's wife and daughter by two Cambridge scholars. The friar tells the story of the Rogius, R-O-G-U-I-S, summoner who is carried by a devil to hell. The summoner in reply comes out with the story of greedy friar, who is humbled on account of his greed. The nun tells a story of miracles. Chaucer himself comes out with perhaps the dullest of tales. His boring narrative is cut short by the host after he has proceeded to the extent of some 30 stanzas. No more of this, for God's dignity, God or hosty, for thou markest me, so weary of thy very lewdness, that also wisely God my soul bless, mine ear aken of thy dusty speech. Chaucer's choice of the dullest tale of himself is a refreshing example of self-directed irony. Only a great humorist can laugh at himself, and Chaucer is certainly among the greatest humorists. He is really delightful in his laughter at his own expense. How can we believe that he was the least skilled of all the narrators? As a man, Chaucer depicts himself, in the word of the host, as an sigh on brustive self-effacing and so contemplating person. His own host addressed him and said thus, "What man art thou? Thou lookest as thou wouldest faint and here, for ever upon a ground I see this tear." On being asked to come out with a tale of mirth by the host, fleet his ignorance very politely. Hosty coat I be beneath revels a pit. After our conclusion of this question, whether or not Chaucer was an obtrusive as a man as he represent himself in Sainsbury tales, it is true that as an artist he followed the principle of least interference with his material, and the degree of his self-effacement is really surprising that he does not project the tint of his likes and dislikes, fads and fetishes, views and prejudices. On what he paints, he is not moralist either. Like Shakespeare says, Captain Rickett, he makes it his business in Sainsbury Tales to paint till the life as he see it, and leaves others to draw the moral. In order to come a close, thus to conclude, in order to come a Chaucer sees what is and paint it as he see it. In order to come a close, and what is more, he effaces himself in order to look at it better. question. Last